Exodus chapter 14 verse 13 to chapter 15 verse 21. The 17th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on October 2, 2016 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 15, Exodus 14:13 to 15:21, accompanies this talk.
We're looking at Exodus again this week. We'll be looking at Exodus, last half of chapter 14 and then chapter 15. Last week I left everyone in suspense. Israelites had fled Egypt. They had gone from where they had been in Egypt. They had gone southeast to Sukkot. And then God directed them to turn. And so it would appear that they went north then, up by the Red Sea. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. And Pharaoh sees them kind of wandering and decides they're lost. They've got problems. It'll be easy to go and corral them and bring them back, and probably shouldn't have let them go in the first place. So Pharaoh puts together an army of chariots, and they take off after the Israelites. And they catch up with them, and they've got them pinned against the Red Sea. Now, my wife was puzzled last week because she couldn't figure out how they got from where I described them being to the Red Sea. So we're going to have to talk about where is the Red Sea. And it's, unfortunately, it's a little bit complicated. The term in Exodus is Yam Suf, and this name appears several times in the Old Testament. It appears at least once with reference to the Gulf of Suez. It also appears at least once as the Gulf of Aqaba. So if you look at, if you've got a map in your Bible, you could see, I don't have those in the map here, but you can see that the Sinai Peninsula has the Gulf of Suez on the west side, and it has the Gulf of Aqaba on the east side. And those both come together. Those are both arms of the Red Sea. And this term, Yam Suf, is used to refer to both of those branches in the Old Testament. The term Yam just means a large body of water. It can mean the sea, Mediterranean Sea, but it could also mean a lake. The Sea of Galilee is referred to as a Yam. It can be either salt or fresh water. And the word Suf means reeds. So it is literally the Sea of Reeds. That's the term in the Bible in the Old Testament. Interestingly, reeds only grow in fresh water. So it makes kind of a complicated picture. There are some scholars that think that the Red Sea reference here in Exodus is a reference to the Gulf of Suez, and that the Israelites passed through the Gulf of Suez, and then into Sinai, and then made their trip. There are a couple of advocates for the view that it refers to the Gulf of Aqaba, and the Israelites went clear across the Sinai Peninsula and were chased there by the Egyptians, and then they passed through the waters of the Gulf of Aqaba and went into what is now Saudi Arabia. Humphreys, by the way, is one who advocates that last perspective. I didn't read anyone who advocated the first perspective, but I know they exist because I see references to it. The Gulf of Aqaba theory, from my perspective, it's just too far to be able to make sense of the narrative. And as I understand it, it would have been very difficult for the Egyptian chariots to make it across the Sinai to that location. The chariots did go through the Sinai, but along that highway that's on the northern edge of the Sinai, that was well traveled by the Egyptians. They used chariots along there all the time. But going midway through the Sinai, going down towards the Gulf of Aqaba, apparently that would have been difficult. So there's a third option, and this is the option that a number of scholars prefer, and that is that the term refers not to either of those bodies of water, but it refers to one of the lakes. that exist on the, it'd be the western edge of the Sinai. And there are a couple of groups of lakes. There are the Bitter Lakes, which are a little southish, and there is the Bala Lakes, which is farther north. Both of these are in a trough that runs from the Mediterranean to the Gulf of Suez, and that is the stretch through which they built the Suez Canal. And as I understand it, these lakes have been incorporated into the Suez Canal. I don't know exactly how that looks, but it's all through there. Okay, so it seems to me that the most reasonable option, given all of the data, and let me explain one of the things that's significant here. I told you a couple weeks ago, archaeologists are not sure where these places that are indicated in Exodus, where they were actually located. Most of them are camping places or springs or something like that, and there are not archaeological ruins there to dig up, and so it's been difficult to identify where some of these places are. But Hofmeyr goes through and tries to make sense of where these are, Baal Zephon, Pi Hahiroth, and there are a couple of other names. Migdol shows up there too, and he gives his best guess as to where those are located. And when he makes his best guess as to where those are located, they all seem to be up farther north by the Bala Lakes. So that's why he thinks that the Bala Lakes, that is the body of water that the Israelites crossed over. And given my level of expertise, it sounded good to me. So I'm going to proceed as though that's the route that they took, and that's the scenario that we're looking at. If you look at your map then, that's in your notes, if you have it, this is a close-up of, if you have the map from the week before, it shows them going down to Sukkot, then north up, and it shows a little bit of blue where there's water. Well, that's this complex of bodies of water. One is actually a lagoon, and the other one is the Bala Lakes. Now, there are several places identified on this map with black dots. Those all identify Egyptian forts. Now, Egyptian forts do leave archaeological remains. Those have been found, and some digging has been done at each of those. Interestingly, most of the work that's being done in the Sinai has all been done relatively recently. It has all been done since the Yom Kippur War, in which Israel got possession of the Sinai. And one of the things that happened while Israel had possession of that is surveys were taken of the ground there to figure out what sites would be good places to dig and all that sort of thing. And a number of those have been now worked on, at least a little bit. So these are all places where remains of Egyptian forts have been located and identified. As best Hofmeyr can reconstruct it then, when they turned north from Sukkot, they came up and then they started going northeast, roughly along that dotted line that you see right along the coastline, and then they turned towards the lake, the Bala Lakes. And it's at that point that the Egyptian army catches up with them. So they're pinned against the Bala Lakes, and the Egyptian army is right behind them. There's really no place for them to go. Okay, is that clear? Do you understand at least what Hofmeyr thinks the situation is? Okay. We'll pick up where we left off in verse 13 of chapter 14. But Moses said to the people, "Do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians, whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent." Now, as you recall, last week, we read the verses that just preceded this. The Israelites are scared to death. They've come to this place where they've got the lake on one side and the Egyptian army is on the other side. There's no place for them to go. There's no way for them to escape. And they complain to Moses and they say, "You just brought us out here to die. What kind of sense does this make?" And we'll see that that is the pattern that the Israelites follow. That is to say, when things get difficult, and there are a number of places we'll see things get difficult for the Israelites, they complain to Moses. We don't see them complaining to God. We see them complaining to Moses. Moses is God's human representative, and he has demonstrated, it seems to me, demonstrated quite clearly that he is God's representative, but he's the one that they call into question. He's the one that they go to and complain to. Moses' response here is, "Do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today." Salvation is a big theme in Exodus. God is saving the people of Israel, and he saves them in a number of respects and in a number of ways, but this is probably the most dramatic. He saves them from being destroyed by the Egyptian army. So Moses says, stand and watch and see what God does. He's going to save you. And the Egyptian, this army that's coming, that you are so afraid of, they are going to disappear and you will never see them again. They're going to be wiped off the face of the earth. In verse 14, the Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. In other words, you don't need to do a thing. Just stand and watch. God's going to do this. Next section. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. And as for you, lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry land. And as for me, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them. And I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord, when I am honored through Pharaoh, through his chariots and his horsemen." And the angel of God, who had been going before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel. And there was the cloud along with the darkness, yet it gave light at night. Thus the one did not come near the other all night. I puzzled over this question that God asks when he says to Moses, "Why are you crying out to me?" And it sounds like this is a criticism of Moses, and it struck me as rather strange. Isn't that exactly what God wants us to do, is to cry out to him? And even if it is not what God wants us to do, there's no indication in the text that Moses had cried out to them. The only mention we have of anyone crying out is in verse 10, where it says, "The sons of Israel cried out to the Lord." And yet in 15, when it says, "Why are you crying out to me?" the "you" is a masculine singular. It's not plural, it's a singular. So this is directed towards Moses. The best solution that I can come up with this, try to figure out what's going on here, is I think what's happening is God is speaking to Moses in his capacity as a representative of the people of Israel. Moses is this intermediary, this go-between, that the people of Israel tend to relate to Moses as if he's God, because he is a representative of God. And it seems to me God is relating to Moses as if he is Israel, because he is a representative of Israel. So I think that that's the best way of making sense of this, that what God is saying is a criticism not of Moses, but of the people of Israel. So the crying out that's being referred to is not a crying out of humility and asking God for his mercy, but it's rather a complaining and kind of accusatorial crying out. "What, God, this is a nasty thing that you've done to us," is the spirit behind it. God then reassures Moses that there is a way out of this. He tells the people of Israel, first of all, he says to them, "Go forward." So there is something for them to do, but all they have to do is go forward. To Moses, he says, "Lift your staff and stretch that over the sea." And he says that the sons of Israel will be able to walk through the sea of reeds. They're going to walk through, not only are they going to be able to walk through, but they'll walk through on dry ground. With respect to the Egyptians, on the other hand, he's going to harden their hearts. They are going to refuse to recognize what's actually going on, and they are going to be compelled by their interests in wanting to corral the Israelites and take them back home. And they are going to go in after with their chariots. And God is going to use that circumstance to bring honor to himself by completely destroying this army. In verse 18, he says, "Then the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord." It's the Egyptians who will learn from this experience and see that God is who he has said that he is. In verse 19, it says that the angel of God moved. It had been going before the camp of Israel, and it went behind them. Then it says, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them. Whether those are two different phenomena or whether they're the same is not clear to me. It could be either, it seems to me. In Hebrews, Jack has advocated that angel is oftentimes just a manifestation of God in some way, and that the cloud could play that kind of role. In any case, this angel and this cloud, they moved from in front of the Israelites to behind the Israelites and were a division, a separation between the two groups. And no one from one group went to where the other group was all night long. So it's nighttime that this is happening right now. Apparently they spend most of the night there encamped, but then in the wee hours of the morning, apparently they are going to start out into the sea. Verse 21, then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry land. So the waters were divided. And the sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Then the Egyptians took up the pursuit, and all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots and his horsemen, went in after them into the midst of the sea. And it came about at the morning watch that the Lord looked down on the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud and brought the army of the Egyptians into confusion. And he caused their chariot wheels to swerve, and he made them drive with difficulty. So the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from Israel, for the Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians." So Moses does just as he was told to do. He stretches out the staff over the body of water, and the wind begins to blow, an east wind begins to blow, and it blows all night long. And as a result of blowing all night long, the waters of the Reed Sea are divided. There is water standing backed up on one side, and there is water standing backed up on the other side. And in fact, the soil underneath the water has dried out, and the Israelites are able to walk through on dry land. And it says, the waters were like a wall to them on their right side and on their left. That must have been a spooky experience. So the Israelites pass through. The Egyptians, they see the waters backed up. They think, well, we'll go too. So they hop in their chariots and they're off and they're making their way through the lake bottom. And as they're crossing just where the Israelites have just been, they begin to have difficulty with their chariots. The chariots have become hard to manage and they're starting to swerve. And the Egyptians are getting spooked and they say to one another, "Let us flee from Israel, for the Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians." So they're scared, and they want to get out of there. The next section. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, so that the waters may come back over the Egyptians, over their chariot and their horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal state at daybreak, while the Egyptians were fleeing right into it. Then the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea, and the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, even Pharaoh's entire army that had gone into the sea after them. Not even one of them remained. But the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea, and the waters were like a wall on them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. And when Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. So once again, Moses stretches out his hand with the staff, and this time the winds cease and the water crashes back into its normal position. And the Israelites have safely made it to the other side, but the Egyptians are still in the lake bed, and they are swamped by the waters returning. The entire army is destroyed. The Israelites see the bodies washed up on the shore as proof of what had happened, as proof that the army had been destroyed. And once again, verse 30 says, "Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians." The last verse, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and his servant Moses. We've seen a similar claim before, that the people of Israel believed Moses and they believed God. But the narrative makes it clear that this is a temporary state for them, that this belief is a thin belief and it does not endure. Okay, the next section then is first part of chapter 15, is a poetic interlude. And there is much discussion about this particular section, and there are several features here that are worthy of note. This, then, at the end of this piece of poetry, we have the end of the narrative with respect to the Exodus proper. That is, their leaving from Egypt proper, and the rest of it enters into their wandering in the wilderness. So we have quite a break in the text, in the narrative in Exodus. This poem, in verse 15, is a well-known passage, and it is referred to by various names in scholarship. There isn't a settled name to refer to this song. Some people refer to it as the Song of Moses, but there is also a Song of Moses in Deuteronomy, and so those could be confused. As a result, some people call it the Song of Miriam, and there are some people who think that Miriam was the one who actually wrote it. And others call it the Song of the Sea, with reference to the Red Sea. So it's referred to by all three of those names. There are references to this song, or at least apparent references to this song. One is in Isaiah 51, and the other one is in Revelation 15. In fact, let me read that, because it's rather interesting. Revelation 15, I'll start with verse 2. "And I saw, as it were, a sea of glass mixed with fire, and those who had come off victorious from the beast and from his image and from the number of his name, standing on the sea of glass, holding harps of God. They sang the song of Moses, the bondservant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, 'Great and marvelous are thy works, O Lord God the Almighty. Righteous and true are thy ways, thou King of the nations. Who will not fear, O Lord, and glorify thy name? For thou art holy. For all the nations will come and worship before thee, for thy righteous acts have been revealed.'" And I'll stop there. It talks about the Song of Moses, and the question is, what is that a reference to? And the consensus seems to be that it's a reference to this chapter in Exodus. And in Revelation, it's hitting similar themes. It doesn't quote from it directly, but it hits some similar themes. In addition to that, there are a couple of places where verse 2 is referred to. In Isaiah 12:2 and Psalm 118, verse 14, both of those quote these lines in verse 2. So this is a well-known song. Scholars say that the language in this song is particularly old. It has a lot of indications that it is extremely old Hebrew. It appears to be a song of praise of greatness, and there are several songs that have been discovered that are classified this way. A number of them are Egyptian, but generally speaking, these songs of greatness are written to praise a king or a pharaoh for his great achievements. And in this case, there is no human who is being praised for his achievements. It's all with reference to God himself. The song has three parts, apparently. The first part is talking about the things that God did in this particular instance. The second part, verses 11 through 13, is talking about God's incomparability. And then the last section, 14 through the end, is talking about the implications of what God has done for and the impact on the nations that Israel will be confronting as it enters the land. And we'll go through each of those sections. But interestingly, when the temple existed, this song was read every Sabbath at the afternoon sacrifices, and it was also read on the seventh day of Passover. Okay. The first section, verses 1 through 10. "Then Moses and the sons of Israel sang this song to the Lord and said, 'I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted.' The horse and its rider he has hurled into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him. My Father's God, and I will extol him. The Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has cast into the sea, and the choicest of his officers are drowned in the Red Sea. The deeps cover them. They went down into the depths like a stone. Thy right hand, O Lord, is majestic in power. Thy right hand, O Lord, shatters the enemy. And in the greatness of thine excellence, thou dost overthrow those who rise up against thee. Thou dost send forth thy burning anger, and it consumes them as chaff. And at the blast of thy nostrils, the waters were piled up. The flowing waters stood up like a heap. The deeps were congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My desire shall be gratified against them. I will draw out my sword, my hand shall destroy them. Thou didst blow them with thy wind, the sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. All of this is describing then different aspects of what God did when he opened up the Red Sea and allowed his people to cross over. Sarna argues, he says, where it says, I will sing to the Lord, that this has to refer to Moses. I'm not sure why he says that this has to refer to Moses, but it is generally believed that this was composed by Moses. He is praising God for all that he did, the destruction of the Egyptian army and the salvation that he has brought. Verse 2, this is my God, and I will praise him, my Father's God, and I will extol him. So here he's making the connection that this is Yahweh, the God who has been leading them out of Egypt, but there is a connection between this God and the God who spoke to Abraham. This is the God of the patriarchs. It's the same God. The Lord is a warrior, and this passage is depicting God in the capacity as a warrior. There is a war being conducted here. It's Yahweh against Pharaoh and his armies. It says the deeps cover them. Now, it seems to me that this is a bit problematic if the location of the Red Sea is the Bala Lakes, because we have a reference to the deeps covering them. Well, do you have the deeps in a lake? The deeps here is the Hebrew word tahom, which usually, if not always, occurs in poetry with respect to and describing the place of where evil lives. The depths of the sea is where evil lives. Evil and chaos dwells. I think that, and certainly if Hoffmeyer is correct in locating the Red Sea at the Bala Lakes, then it seems to me what's happening in this song, this is being described in poetic terms, and what is being described is, it's an allusion to Canaanite mythology. And I've mentioned this briefly before, and I'm not going to talk about it at length now, but in Canaanite mythology, we have myths that have been found that describe Baal fighting against the forces of chaos and defeating them and establishing order and establishing justice. I think that what we have here is Moses is tapping into that cultural theme and is putting God in the place of the one who defeats evil and putting Pharaoh in the place of that force of evil. And the Tahom then is a poetic reference to the fate that Pharaoh experiences. And I think it's that reference to that mythology from Canaan that helps explain the language that we've seen throughout, where this is being described as a battle, as war. So remember when the Israelites left Egypt, they left with plunder. Well, it wasn't plunder, they were gifts. But as seen as a battle, then it plays the role of plunder. That is, they took wealth from the defeated. So I suspect that there's something like that going on here. interestingly, in verse 9, it says, the enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil, my desire. So here we have the arrogance of the enemy being shown, the arrogance of Pharaoh. And yet God is just a blow of wind from God that destroys Pharaoh. There is no contest. And that's the theme of the next section, 11 through 13. Who is like thee among the gods, O Lord? Who is like thee, majestic in holiness, awesome in praises, working wonders? Thou didst stretch out thy right hand, the earth swallowed them. In thy loving kindness thou hast led the people whom thou hast redeemed. In thy strength thou hast guided them to thy holy habitation. The incomparability of God is a frequent theme in the Old Testament. There is nothing that compares with God, and that's the theme that's being hit here. None of the other gods even come close. There is no comparison. Verse 13, when it says, in thy loving kindness thou hast led the people whom thou hast redeemed, in thy strength thou hast guided them to thy holy habitation. Where is that holy habitation? It would appear that what he has in mind here is Mount Sinai. That's the place where they are headed. He had told Moses that he was going to bring the people there, and that seems to be what he has in mind when he says the holy habitation. In Psalm 78, verse 54, he says, he brought them to his holy realm, the mountain his right hand had acquired. And that appears to be a reference to Mount Sinai as well. But we'll see another reference to a mountain a little bit later, and we'll see if we can put those together. Verse 14, the peoples have heard, they tremble. Anguish has gripped the inhabitants of Philistia. Then the chiefs of Edom were dismayed. The leaders of Moab trembling grips them. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them. By the greatness of thine arm, they are motionless as stone. Until thy people pass over, O Lord, until the people pass over whom thou hast purchased. Thou wilt bring them and plant them in the mountain of thine inheritance, the place, O Lord, which thou hast made for thy dwelling, the sanctuary, O Lord, which thy hands have established. The Lord shall reign forever and ever. Here is talking about the impact of this on the peoples in the area, and in particular the peoples that they will encounter as they move into the promised land. The order in which they're addressed is curious. The first is Philistia. Philistia was an area that they did not go through when they were entering into the promised land. They encounter the Philistines at a later date. But it's possible that these were listed first as being the most powerful, the most difficult to deal with. The rest of them occur in the order in which they encountered them. Edom first, Moab second, and then the inhabitants of Canaan. The impact that this has on them is they are scared to death. They hear about what has happened, and they are very much afraid of the Israelites coming. And that's going to play a big role in the Israelites' ability to take the land, because there is so much fear in the hearts of the Canaanites when they come. Once again, in verse 17, we have reference to this is in the mountain of thine inheritance. And the question is, what mountain are we talking about? And once again, this could be a reference to Mount Zion, but it does say, thou wilt bring and plant them in the mountain of thine inheritance. Did God plant them in Zion? So it could be a reference to what is later, I meant Mount Sinai. They do come to Mount Zion later, and that is the place which God made for his dwelling. That's where the sanctuary was established, the temple. So it could be that this is ultimately referring to that. And it could be that it's referring to something more permanent than either of those. That is God's eternal dwelling place. Then verse 18, the Lord shall reign forever and ever. So this is the song that was sung as they're on the southeast shore of the lake that they have crossed through, because God had opened it up for them to do so, and the Egyptian army was destroyed in the lake. Verse 19 through 21 tells us the setting in which this happened. For the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and his horsemen went into the sea, And the Lord brought back the waters of the sea on them. But the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea. And Miriam, the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took the timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with timbrels and with dancing. And Miriam answered them, "Sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and his rider he has hurled into the sea." So you can imagine a big celebration. This is an amazing thing that's happened. They are thrilled to have seen what they have seen, experienced what they have experienced, and to have been saved the way that they have been saved. So Moses then apparently composes this song, and then it is performed, and apparently Moses and perhaps the men sing it, and then the women, with Miriam leading them, responds. So it's a portion is sung by the men, then the women repeat it. That's apparently the way this was performed. Okay. All right. Just a few comments and then we'll do questions and answers and comments. One of the things that's striking here is that this is one of the preeminent examples of God doing the impossible. That he had brought the Israelites into a position where there was no hope. There was no way out of this. And God did the impossible. He did what no one could have imagined that would happen. And that is, he just opens up the sea and the Israelites walk through. So this is an amazing event that has occurred. And this is like with the Passover. This is an event that is to be remembered because God doesn't do this all the time. This was relatively unique. There are times when God has chosen to reach into history and act very overtly, but that is rare. And those times are to be remembered because we go through these stretches where God isn't that overt. He isn't acting like that. And it's only by keeping that memory alive that we can have the assurance that he is the kind of God that does that kind of thing. It is proof that he can. He is both able and willing to save his people. This was an example of his willingness and ability to save them. And that is ultimately the example that we can look back upon with respect to the salvation that he extends to us, the salvation from our sins, which is what we've built our hope on. God does that. God can do that, and he will do that. But in our daily experience, he is not overtly active. He prefers to stay in the background. The second thing that I wanted to talk about is something I thought about quite a bit. When can we celebrate? When you've lived long enough, what you recognize is there's a sense in which any celebration is a little bit hollow because trouble's just around the corner. You may be celebrating the fact that you've come through X, but Y is coming up pretty soon. And that's exactly what happens in this story, as we'll see next week. 3 days later, they've taken off now. They've left the place where they celebrated. 3 days later, they've still got the hats on their heads from the celebration. 3 days later, they're out of water. Next week, I want to talk about that event with respect to the Israelites, because it tells us a lot about the Israelites. But this time, I want to talk about what it tells us about God, that's the way God operates, that it is not uncommon for God to provide very gracious help to get us through some problem. I suspect everyone has experienced that in one way or another. I've experienced that many times where I was at the end of my rope and something happened that kind of dissolved the situation, took the tenseness out of it, that somehow it was not the problem that it had been. And that's fantastic when that happens. But you know that another problem is just a day or two away. There's going to be another one, and there's going to be another one. That's the nature of life, is it's just going from one of those problems to another. So when do you celebrate? Just speaking personally, there have been stretches when God did something in my life that was quite significant, but it was after a string of very difficult things that had come along. And it's like, what's the point of celebrating? You know that another problem is just around the corner. It seems to me that victories ought to be celebrated. There's a sense in which we ought to take note of what God has done and the escape that he has provided from our whatever our circumstances are, the salvation that he has provided from whatever we were in. But it only makes sense to keep that in perspective, that any celebration in this life is going to be a guarded celebration. That is to say, we need to be not naive about it. We need to recognize it is the nature of life that there will be other problems that come along. But that doesn't mean that a celebration ought not be a real celebration and a real recognition of what God has done and gratitude for what God has done, because he is very gracious towards us. As I look at my life, and if I'm fair about it, God has been extremely gracious towards me. There are a number of times when I've been in very difficult circumstances, and God never responded as quickly as I wanted him to. But there have been some remarkable things that he has done in my life. And it's important that I not forget those. And it's important that I not take those for granted. Okay, questions or comments?
When the pioneers were coming across to California and Oregon, they often had a lot of trouble with their wagons drying out as they crossed Utah and Nevada. Mm-hmm. And it was such that the spokes in their wagon wheels would become smaller because they had so much less water in them. Mm. And that the wheels would often fall off the wagons.
And that's it occurred not good.
To me that that's the same thing that happened to Pharaoh's chariots after this dry wind came and blew the water away. Mm. And it says the wheels came off the chariots. And I'll bet you that's what was happening there too.
Possible. Egypt's pretty dry, so it may not have been the exact same phenomenon. It's possible, though.
It's true they would be having to cross the desert, mm-hmm. but I imagine next to the Nile it's wetter anyway.
It's possible. Mm-hmm.
I find myself continuing to try to escape the Cecil B. DeMille mm-hmm. version of this
good.
Event.
Good. I wish you success.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems to me there's at least 2 days to this event. It said, so the Egyptians caught up with them, the cloud and the pillar stood between them in the back.
Right. And that's apparently happening like evening.
Yeah. And Moses stretched out his hand and the Lord swept the sea by a strong east wind all night. And the waters were divided on their right hand. I've actually read that when the Israelites went down in and the sea was a wall, one author said that that could be translated defense. It was a defense on their right and their left. That would be an interesting comment because typically charioteers do not do a head-on attack. They parallel the column and they sweep in and out. And in warfare during that period, the driver drove the chariot, but the archer or the spearman had this golf club bag mm-hmm. full of spears, darts, or arrows. And the chariots would parallel the column launching. And sometimes they could actually herd them like sheep. Or they would do this sweeping in and out thing where they would sweep in, throw a bunch of arrows and sweep out, sweep in, throw a bunch of arrows, which they couldn't do if this was a protected column mm-hmm. with a defense on their right and their left. Mm-hmm. Which so it makes sense with what I know about military history of that era. But it says, at the morning watch, the Lord looked down on the army of the Egyptians. And then later in 27, it said, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea at daybreak, and the sea returned to its original dimensions. So it seems like there's 2 days there. The first day, Israelites started down through this previously wet area, and the water did not allow the Pharaoh's chariots to do what the chariots did. The next day, they charged down into the same space that the Israelites had used, and the waters closed in. So am I getting that?
The chronology is not clear. The way I've put it together, the pillar moves between the Egyptians and the Israelites late afternoon or early evening. The Israelites are camped there for much of the night. Then they move out in the wee hours of the morning. And is it at daybreak then that the waters come crashing in? So that's the way I've put it together. But could there be another 24 hours in there? There could. I don't know why not.
How much does it matter if we actually find the actual spot?
Well, I think it's huge. And if I had money to bet, I'd bet that something's found. The reason I think that's the case is because the Old Testament is actually building quite a bit on this event. Israel was supposed to keep the memory of this alive. They're supposed to celebrate it every year, the Passover and the Exodus. So the historicity of this is extremely important. And so I think that there is a good possibility that something will be found that is testimony to the historical reality of this thing. But that's speculation. Now, with respect to this parting of the sea, there was an experiment that was done. Under certain conditions with a body of water, if you have a ridge in that body of water and the wind blows, you can have the water over here left standing. We have this ridge here, and then the wind pushing back the waters here, and you can actually have a passageway between two bodies of water. And here, on this side, you actually have the water standing because the wind's blowing against it. Over here, you don't really have the water standing, as I understand it. And I guess they've done an experiment where they built a sea floor and they blew wind and they created that effect. So there's speculation that, something like that was at play. I don't know.
The one I read was a couple of German engineers. They were going on the Red Sea model, and they said with a certain humidity and a certain wind that you could literally dry out an area. And he talks about the...
But would it create the split?
Of course, because there's a ridge that rises up.
Okay, there, if there's a ridge.
And so you'd have a defense on your right and your left, which would act like a wall.
Yeah.
So they're even finding a road still where it happened.
Yeah. It is interesting here that even if this is a miracle that breaks the law of chemistry and physics, it does say that it was a wind that created this effect. So it has a natural cause at that point.
Hi, David. I was thinking about your last point about celebrating, and it tied into some questions I've been having lately about what the role of joy is in our lives, because the Bible talks about joy a lot, and it sounds like something that we're supposed to have, whatever that is exactly. So I thought maybe you could comment on that because, well,
Yeah. I think there is a sense in which we should be joyous. And the reason we should be joyous is because it is an amazing thing that God has done in human experience. That much like the joy that they're experiencing having passed through the Red Sea, and you can just imagine the joy that they're experiencing. That would be phenomenal to be there. Well, if we reflect on what it is that God has done in history, he has provided an even greater salvation for us. And as a result, there's a sense in which we should be dancing on the shore, celebrating what God has done there, which is phenomenal. The problem is life, it's the everydayness of life that kind of overwhelms and drowns out the bigger picture. And as a result, it's not joy generally that we experience. But it seems to me that it is important for us to keep things in perspective such that there is a joy that's there in the midst of all the yuckiness and all the problems and stuff, because God is doing a grand thing in history, an amazing thing in history, and we are beneficiaries of that. We are fortunate to be beneficiaries of that, and that's amazing. And there's a sense in which we can kind of stand back and look even at our own lives and take joy in what God has done. And we should.
Yeah, because I was thinking of when you were saying today something wonderful may happen and God, it may be really, really clear that God has done this amazing thing. But then tomorrow there's another trouble right around the,
right.
the corner.
Right.
That there's a sense in which that makes the here and now too real when the reality is what you've been talking about just now about what God is doing in kind of the big grand story that we're a part of.
And that's the source of our joy. And when God is gracious to us in various ways through our life, or something happens that's worth celebrating, we can celebrate it, but that's just a portion of the bigger joy leaking through into our day-to-day experience. It's that bigger joy that's really the source of our hope, our faith, everything.
Thanks.
You guys have got me wanting to break out into song here. David, in the Song of Moses, it talks about how God purchased the people, and then it gets echoed in the Bible, a people of his own possession. Can you explain that? Because I'm not sure, is that a figurative, or was there some kind of exchange, or how does this purchase?
Well, I assume that in the context where this is, the firstborn lived because lambs were killed. that there was a, let me think about that one.
Okay, I'm thinking about it too.
I was thinking it's just tied to the Passover, but maybe it's not. Let me think about that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks.